Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Bucharest.
Hello, coming up in the programme. The Dutch general election's almost upon us, but it's not as boring as you'd think. The mudslinging started.
He's just frightened of me. She also later called him a crybaby.
The far right still lurking on the fringes of mainstream European politics. We hear if the neo-Nazi element is being contained in Germany, Sweden and Holland. And Airbus, the pan-European business, is facing problems. Will its new super jumbo venture ever get off the ground?
Airbus is back on the track and I believe everybody has to be sure that Airbus will take all its place with a lot of ambition, and we are pushing forward.
Hello and welcome to Network Europe. I'm Richard Walker. There's a general election in the Netherlands next week, and although there's little chance of it making waves across Europe, it's suddenly livened up Dutch public life. Dreary campaign manifestos have given way to good old-fashioned personality politics and slanging matches. Now, if you don't know who's in the current Dutch government or why you should care, don't worry. Radio Netherlands' man in The Hague is Andy Clark, and he's been telling me who the major players in Dutch politics are and how they've been upping the ante.
Well, they've certainly been going at each other in the past few days, something you'd probably expect the closer we get to election day itself. But it is unusual for Dutch politics to get so personal. Now, this all really started at the beginning of the campaign, actually, when the normally reserved Prime Minister Jan-Peter Balkenende launched an attack on his biggest challenger in the election race, the opposition Labour Party leader Wouter Bos. Here's what he said. That was a direct insult, basically, from the Prime Minister, calling his challenger dishonest. He repeated that several times and accusing him of constantly changing his mind. Now, an awful lot was made of that attack in the media, and Wouter Bos took to the television the next day to call for a better quality of debate, saying we shouldn't sink to the level of personal insults.
They always do, though, don't they? I mean,
they always do, election campaigns. Yeah. Absolutely. He's tried sticking to this line, Wouter Bos, but it didn't do him much good as the attacks kept on coming, with the VVD joining in too. Now the VVD is the other party in the government coalition, along with the Prime Minister's Christian Democrat CDA party. Now, ultimately, the attacks led Wouter Bos to complain that the government parties were trying to destroy him. This in an article in the country's biggest selling newspaper. And what do you think they did after that, then?
Well, I imagine they all just made friends and carried on in a civil manner.
Actually, no, not quite. Seeing the opposition man down, of course, the government parties decided it was time for more, and the hardline immigration minister Rita Verdonk, one who's never shy and retiring from the cameras and the microphones, decided it was time to stick the boot in. And here's what she said.
Ja, je krijgt toch wel de indruk dat Wouter Bos nu al bemerkt dat...
You get the impression that Wouter Bos realizes his dream of becoming prime minister is never going to happen, she said, and then the sting in the tail. He's just frightened of me, she added. She also later called him a crybaby.
And how did he take that? Did he hit back?
Well, yeah, eventually. It took a while. I mean, he's known for being mild-mannered. He's renowned for shunning formality, never wears a tie, is always seen smiling on TV. But even for the opposition Labour Party leader, Wouter Bos, this was too much, and eventually he did come out fighting.
Hoe kan het CDA pleiten voor respect?
How can the Prime Minister talk about respect, said Bos, when he constantly walks on the leash of Rita Verdonk? And on the accusation he was frightened of Rita Verdonk.
Nee, Rita, voor jou zijn maar twee mannen bang. Mark Rutte en Jan-Peter Balkenende. Want die...
Much applause, of course. Well, that was a Labour Party rally, so a friendly audience. But Wouter Bos was saying he wasn't frightened of Rita Verdonk and that there are only two men who are frightened of her, one being her own party leader, Mark Rutte, and the other being the Prime Minister, Balkenende himself. He says they're frightened of her because they've never dared confront her.
Right, and it's not just here, is it? Elsewhere, both on the right and left in this campaign, that there have been harsh words said and mud slung about.
Indeed, the right wing in particular has been excelling itself in over-the-top campaigning in the last few days. This is Marco Pastors, former deputy mayor of Rotterdam, who now has his own right-wing party, One Netherlands.
Voor de Tweede Wereldoorlog durfde de gevestigde orde de Duitsers niet aan te pakken.
That's his radio campaign message. You ready for this? He draws a comparison between the occupation of the Netherlands by the Nazis in World War II with the rise of Islam now. In particular, he says the failure to tackle the rise of Nazism before World War II is comparable to the situation now.
Now, this is extraordinary, isn't it? Is this a serious political party, Andy?
He has no seats in the opinion polls, let's just say that.
Interesting. Now, Andy, finally and quickly, who's going to win this election?
Well, it's difficult to say. It's still pretty close, but the CDA party, the Christian Democrat party of the Prime Minister, Jan-Peter Balkenende, has staged a remarkable surge in the polls in the last few weeks. Just a few months ago, there were some 20 seats behind the Labour Party. And now the irony is that the Labour Party and the Christian Democrats may well have to work together after the vote because the numbers don't add up to form a left-wing or a right-wing coalition. So the two parties, despite all of the mudslinging, despite all of the criticism, may well end up working together.
That was Radio Netherlands correspondent in The Hague, Andy Clark. Now, Andy was telling me about the brazen scaremongering of far-right groups in Holland as they try to establish a foothold on the domestic political scene. But that's something Germany's far-right National Democratic Party already enjoys. It held a convention last weekend that sparked debate about whether or not to try to ban them. It was tried and failed 3 years ago. The whole plan was scuppered when it came to light that some of the intelligence agents who'd infiltrated the party undercover had got a little too into character and were actually involved in provoking some of the bannable behaviour. As Hardy Grautner reports from Berlin, many politicians in Germany want to muzzle the party but are asking if a ban is useful or realistic.
After Germany's highest court turned down a bid to ban the NPD in 2003, the party's far-right followers have stuck to their neo-Nazi cause with renewed confidence. Riding on a wave of voter disenchantment with the political mainstream, the NPD has since made it into two federal state parliaments. In Berlin, it is currently represented in four assemblies at district level. At Saturday's national convention, re-elected party leader Udo Vogt left no doubt whatsoever where he and his followers draw their ideology from. He welcomed delegates to the Reich Capital, a Nazi-era term for Berlin. Phrases like this have brought fresh calls for legal action against the NPD and a total ban on the party. But Volker Ratzemann, floor leader of the opposition Greens in the city-state of Berlin, believes that the judiciary can only do so much. Our basic law protects parties as long as they're not banned, whether people like what they do or not, he says. Civil society is now called upon to show NPD followers that although they may not be fought by law, their ideology and thinking won't have a future in Germany, because they are not accepted by the majority of people living here. But for Berlin's Social Democrat Interior Minister Erhard Körting, banning the NPD remains a top priority. He is being supported by Vice Chancellor Franz Müntefering, who doesn't hide his desire to see the NPD banned as quickly as possible.
Erstens, die Präventionsarbeit verbessern.
We have to step up preventive measures to ensure that young people do not blindly follow hardcore Nazis surrounding this party, he says. But I won't beat about the bush. We'll also have to see whether we can ban the NPD in a second attempt. I'd be in favour without any ifs or buts. But his party colleague Ratzemann warns that immediate legal action is out of the question. Even if the NPD gets banned one fine day, nobody should then rest on their laurels and think the problem is resolved once and for all, he says. A fresh attempt to ban the party will be very difficult. Back in 2003, the Constitutional Court sent out a clear signal in regard to the use of undercover intelligence agents. You cannot just withdraw all agents now and start legal proceedings immediately. You simply need a couple of years to remove all agents and gather fresh evidence that you can use against the party in court. The majority of Germany's state interior ministers are against a ban. The NPD, they say, has to be fought with political arguments. They also argue that far-right populist ideas would not fall on fertile ground if the unemployment rate came down further. Others are simply afraid that the second failed attempt to ban the party would see the NPD emerge with even more clout. They argue that even the very debate about whether to ban it or not is counterproductive, as it gives the party undeserved public attention. Hardy Graupner, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
Now, the far-right obviously has something of a history in Germany, but far-right political parties are making their presence felt in many parts of Europe, even in the liberal heartland of Scandinavia. Recent elections in Sweden have given the country's far-right party, the Sweden Democrats, some unwelcome power, especially if you're an asylum seeker. Radio Sweden's Mark Cummins joins me on the line from Stockholm. Mark, what do you know about the Sweden Democrats?
Well, it's difficult to say exactly what they stand for. The party says it wants to, quote, keep Sweden Swedish. But all through the election campaign, and even after, of course, when they've been pressed to define just what they mean by Swedishness, the party representatives can't really define it. What they seem to be representing is a vision of Sweden based in the 1950s, a sort of ethnically homogeneous, perhaps a less complex society with uniform values and goals. An image that it is just that, a very sort of homogenized, simplistic picture of what Sweden actually ever was. Commentators in the media here have been pointing out that that kind of Sweden really never existed, and that this country, like most of Europe, has had waves of immigrants for hundreds, if not thousands of years. Another aspect of their success, it's been suggested, is the fact that they're voicing is sort of diffuse unease that some Swedes feel about today's multicultural society. And that sort of unease hasn't been allowed almost to be mentioned in polite conversation. There's been a big discussion in Sweden on just how much room in the media the party should be given. I know that we here at Swedish Radio talked a lot about that. In general, what was settled on is that the party is referred to as a xenophobic and an anti-immigrant party.
And in that sense, definitely taking a line against them, there's no pretense of objectivity.
Absolutely not. And it's something that's been a troubling sort of discussion that has been going on for some time. How do we represent them? How should we talk about them? Because they are, of course, sitting in assemblies across the country now.
They do have supporters, don't they? How successful was the party in the recent elections?
Well, the party received just under 3% nationally. Now, that's below the threshold for getting into Swedish parliament, the national parliament, the Riksdagen. But even that for Sweden was a major success for a party that just a few years ago was virtually unknown. That 3% result does, though, give them public financing through Sweden's system of support to political organisations. And that means hundreds of thousands of euros will come into the party coffers. The real success, though, was really on the local and regional level, notably in the far southern regions, actually facing the continent, interestingly enough. The party got some 55,000 votes in the southern province of Skåne, and they sit on 40 local assemblies across the country. And in 12 of those, they actually have the balance of power between the two left and right political blocs.
They sound like they have some real power in local government, then.
Well, it really remains to be seen how much they're actually going to have. There's been, of course, an ongoing effort to keep them out of any sort of forum where they could influence. What happens, though, is that as they're being represented in local government, under the Swedish constitution, the party now has the right to name something that in Sweden is called lay judges into the 33 district courts. Now, lay judges is a very Swedish judicial construct. It takes the place of juries in this country. The public is represented by politically appointed lay judges who assist professional judges at a local court level. So it's sort of complicated, but what it does is something that's always been held up as a democratic virtue in Sweden. But now the catch is that these representatives of the right-wing party, the Sweden Democrats, anti-immigrant party, will get to influence rulings in asylum and immigration cases, which is actually heard at this level in Sweden.
I imagine then the debate will be moving swiftly on to whether or not the constitutional structure that allowed this to happen should be amended.
That's right, but it opens a whole sort of can of worms here. And I think that would be very difficult to affect. What we have seen in Sweden before is a populist party and a protest party that rose to power very quickly in the early 90s. What happened there was that as soon as it was very much a case of giving them enough rope, as soon as they did have a forum to view their ideas, people realized what they were, and their popularity really disappeared very quickly in a matter of a number of months. And they, of course, in the next election, didn't get any votes and didn't get back into parliament. I think secretly that's what most people are hoping it will happen with the Sweden Democrats.
OK, thanks, Mark. Mark Cummins from Radio Sweden there. And joining the discussion is Network Europe's Brussels correspondent, Stephen Castle, on the line. So, Stephen, you heard what Mark was just saying there. Is the prospect of neo-Nazis deciding the fate of asylum seekers in Swedish courtrooms enough to attract the concern of EU lawmakers, or does it have to be more threatening to get their attention?
I think potentially it could do, although maybe you're correct that this won't be on the agenda here quite yet. The EU went through a big crisis over an issue very similar to this in the year 2000, when the far right was voted into government in Austria and brought into the ruling coalition. There was a big crisis, there were sort of political sanctions against the Austrians. And in the end, that situation couldn't be sustained. And what the EU did instead was it changed its governing treaty so that now it has pretty clear rules that it won't interfere in a country unless it is clear that there's evidence that fundamental rights, the EU's fundamental rights that it guards, such as freedom of speech, democracy, an independent judiciary, only if those rights are breached that the EU will get involved.
And as far as you can tell in Brussels at the moment, there are no noises about that possibly happening in Sweden or Germany.
I think it's an issue which is constantly under review. The EU has a role in policing these fundamental rights. It likes to, if it can, in terms of the Commission, to keep its nose out of domestic politics, because it knows that actually interfering in domestic politics can sometimes exacerbate the situation.
Now, I think an issue that arguably fuels neo-Nazi support is a fear of foreigners and migration and people coming and stealing local jobs. And that's been back on the agenda firmly this week in Brussels, hasn't it, with the Services Directive?
Well, the Services Directive, yes, it cleared an important hurdle this week, the one approval from the European Parliament in Strasbourg. And really this is a kind of landmark piece of legislation. It's been haggled over for at least 3 years. And essentially what it seeks to do is to sweep away some of those barriers that exist in Europe and open up this multi-billion euro market in services across the EU. Everything we're talking here from architects to plumbers, so that people can set up business in other member states. And it was indeed one of the key issues in the French referendum on the European Constitution. That referendum came up with a no vote. And one of the reasons for that was a fear of the invasion of Polish plumbers,
so to speak. And the French said no, the Dutch said no, and I know this was one of the main reasons that they said no, but nonetheless, the deal's going through and it's a compromise, but it's not pandering to that no, is it?
In a sense, it is pandering to that no, because it is a compromise. And after the referendum rejections of the European Constitution, there was a great deal of debate in Brussels about how to proceed with this piece of legislation. And it was indeed significantly watered down. And one of the key elements now that's in the new legislation, which will come into force eventually, is that when companies set up business in foreign countries, they will have to obey the labour law of the nation in which they are operating. In other words, if a Lithuanian firm sets up business in France, it'll be French labour law, not Lithuanian labour law, that applies. And that means that it will make it much more difficult for these companies to undercut social standards, to do away with the basic minimums. And that was the real fear, particularly from the left.
Network Europe's Brussels correspondent Stephen Castle there. And it's up, up and away for Europe's big aeroplane makers, Airbus, this week. Their new A380 Super Jumbo has taken off from France on its first round-the-world test flights. But Airbus's staff and suppliers are worried about the future. The Finnish planes are being delivered up to 2 years late because of production problems, so now costs are being cut, and maybe jobs too. This week, French Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin went to Toulouse in southern France, promising he wouldn't let Airbus down. Radio France International's Nick Champeau went with him.
The delivery delays of the A380 Super Jumbo jet are not a mega problem. We can and will overcome the challenges we're currently facing. That's what Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin told Airbus employees at the assembly line of the A320 aircraft in Toulouse.
Airbus is back on the track, and I believe everybody has to be sure that Airbus will take all its place with a lot of ambition, and we are pushing forward.
Because when the A380 is behind schedule, France's economy is also behind its European partners, so it's a symbol.
Every company has sometimes difficulties. What is important is the reaction, the reactivity the reactivity of the company, the reactivity of all the companies that are working for Airbus, and also the reaction of the different states that are supporting Airbus. So we are there, and we are looking forward.
On his 53rd birthday, Villepin received a model of an Airbus plane from workers and a trophy from one of the company's suppliers. But Villepin also had his own gifts to hand out. He pledged 145 million euros for the aeronautics sector. The announcement has led to mixed reactions among these young Airbus technicians.
I'm not worried. We're good at conception, manufacturing, and we're good in sales. We've been successful so far, and there is no reason this should ground to a halt.
I work for Airbus by a temping agency. My contract ends in February. I don't know if they will renew it. If there is work, we get more firm orders, yes, but you're never sure.
Villepin also encouraged Airbus management to sign a partnership charter with subcontractors, in which Airbus would promise to pay suppliers on time, which is not the case at the moment. But Airbus and the French government are taking a stick-and-carrot approach. The company has launched a vast cost-cutting restructuring plan called Energy 8 Power 8 to make up for the costly production delays of its A380 Star project. Airbus no longer wants to work with the 3,000 different suppliers it has in France alone. There will be work for everybody, but we want our suppliers to work together. We want to speak to less people, said Airbus CEO Louis Gallois. He warned that the Airbus board would probably refuse to give the green light to its new A350 jetliner if these expectations were not met.
Power 8 is a program designed to make the entire Airbus chain competitive, and that chain includes Airbus and its suppliers. We will ask the Airbus board to give its go-ahead to the A350 only if we have guarantees that our Power 8 program will be enforced, because Power 8 is partly why Airbus will remain competitive in the future. So there is a direct link between this program and the launch of our new jetliner.
The A350 was drawn up by Airbus as a competitor for Boeing's popular 787 Dreamliner. If it doesn't see the light of day, suppliers, as a result, will receive less contracts. Airbus subcontractors said they would do their best, but they told Villepin that working in the Eurozone made it difficult to compete with American companies. François Jinca is CEO of Latéco Air, one of Airbus's suppliers. He employs 3,000 people.
80% of our turnover is in dollars. 30% of our expenses are in dollars. So our activity depends a lot on the euro-dollar exchange rate. What's costing us a lot of money is that we pay our employees in euros, but our clients pay us in dollars.
Villepin took note of the remark. In fact, he did more. He called on the EU to adopt a genuine monetary strategy.
L'Europe a besoin d'un bouclier monétaire.
Europe needs a shield for the euro. The difficulties of Airbus are partly the result of a euro that is too strong against the dollar, which hurts our industry in the face of US competition. All the major powers have an exchange rate policy, sometimes even an aggressive one. The European Union must provide itself with a proper exchange rate strategy that combines the goals of growth, the protection of our industry, and the protection of jobs.
It's unsure how directors of the European Central Bank will take this. They're often reluctant to modify rates. Villepin's reimbursable advances are not likely to be well received by Boeing managers in the U.S. either. But for the French premier, protecting Airbus, the pride of France and a flagship of the country's industrial know-how, is worse a fight, even if it means taking on Frankfurt, Washington and Brussels.
Radio France International's Nick Champeau on the French fight to preserve Airbus. And speaking of conflict, we move seamlessly from aviation to regeneration in Poland. In the Second World War, the Polish capital, Warsaw, was all but flattened. Rebuilding the old town was the largest renovation project in the history of Europe. The Poles are obviously keen on monopolising this sort of title because they've just started the next biggest project of this kind. Łódź is Poland's second largest city, but it isn't usually on tourist to-do lists. But it might be now. The town's manufacturer complex has had a huge makeover. I'm booking my flight now. Amy Drozdowska of Radio Polonia has more.
The heart of Łódź is beating again. So say the advertisements for Manufaktura, the city's latest project for revitalization. It's also Poland's largest renovation project since the 1950s reconstruction of Warsaw's old town. The 150,000 square meter Manufaktura is said to be the biggest cultural, business, and amusement center in Europe. And for residents like Antek, Łódź has been longing for something to brag about.
I mean, I think it fills an incredible vacuum. You know, people in Łódź tend to be negative about their city, and this is something that they're proud of. It's big, it's clean, it's modern. It makes them feel more worldly.
The core of Łódź contains an impressive sprawl of mammoth red brick factories and tall chimneys. The problem is, they've been out of use for a long time, including the ones owned and run by one of Łódź's richest and most powerful industrial magnates, the Israel Poznański family. The extensive complex of huge neo-Gothic warehouses embodies the city's past. Sylwia Dacińska, who's been working with the Manufaktura project from the start, explains.
Manufaktura is the old factory of Israel Poznański. It's very close to the heart of every inhabitant from Łódź, because in the best times of the factory, Israel Poznański employed 12 to 14,000 people. So almost everyone from Łódź has someone from his family or from his friends who was working here. It makes a lot of emotions when you are coming here after a few years and you see Manufaktura, something which is very modern, very beautiful, but it is not a factory anymore.
Dacińska works for the development firm Apsys Polska. In 1999, Apsys was hired by the city of Łódź to create a new life for the group of factories and for Łódź. Manufaktura is set to house over 230 shops, a cinema with 15 screens and an IMAX 3D theater, a science museum geared toward children, a modern art center, a discotheque, a fitness center, a conference center, an office block, and a four-star hotel. The cultural hub of the complex is the huge Rynek, or Market Square. It's a space measuring over 30,000 square meters. Stretching from one end to the other is a 300-meter-long fountain. If you're overwhelmed by the long walk across the square, there's a free trolley waiting to let you be lazy. Around the square, signs feature Manufaktura's three main themes: shopping, entertainment, and museums. For lots of visitors, though, shopping is the main reason they've come to Manufaktura.
I'm going here to buy some things, some clothes, some books in Empik.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's really nice. It's called the shops.
Have you been to any of the other parts of the complex besides the mall?
What else is there?
Saeed's not alone in wondering. A lot of the more cultural attractions, like the museums, are still under construction. Opening dates keep being delayed. So for some visitors, especially on an ordinary weekday when there's no concerts or festivals filling the square, Manufaktura can feel less about culture and more about consumerism.
It is too bad that they couldn't use it somehow more culturally positive to make people aware the city that they live in has a place not just in the history of itself, but in the history of the world.
It's still hard to say what the final form and feel of this historic factory complex will be. But in the meantime, Manufaktura has created over 3,500 jobs for Łódź residents, and even opportunities for young artists.
And I think the Manufaktura is a chance. It's a chance for Łódź. It's a reason that people will come to Łódź.
Residents and tourists will have to decide whether the heart of Łódź will be housed in Manufaktura. But whether the heart of the city or an incredibly decorative appendage, the place is certainly alive.
Amy Drozdowska of Radio Polonia there. And just a reminder of this month's Network Europe quiz question before I go. The winner of this will be getting some pretty exciting stuff, I can tell you. European agriculture's full of quotas, isn't it? And often the upshot of these is surpluses. The wine industry's no exception. And what I want to know is, how many swimming pools will the European wine surplus, or wine lake as it's known, fill? Answers please to contact at networkeurope.org. Well, that's all we've got time for today. This programme is a partnership of Radio France International, Radio Sweden, Radio Polonia, Deutsche Welle, Radio Netherlands, Radio Romania International, Radio Slovakia, Radio Prague, Radio Ukraine and Radio Slovenia. Network Europe will, of course, be back next week. So on behalf of our pan-European team, this is Richard Walker. Thanks for joining us.
Your sister.